Well, holding on Ayin Chesed Beis, just past the middle of the Amud, the line begins Al Tzarzeh. So we were discussing, the Mishnah had been talking about the various cases where a woman has Nechasim, when we say that she's able to sell them, when we say she's able to sell them without the husband being able to interfere, versus when we say that she shouldn't sell them, L'chatchila, but B'dievet, if she did, it's fine, versus when we say that even B'dievet, the husband can take them back. And the last thing we talked about was we said that we had two different understandings of Rabbi Gamliel's opinion. One was Rabbi Yehuda's opinion, the other was Rabbi Chananim ben Akavya. Rabbi Yehuda had said that you shouldn't sell a chatzila, but b'dievet it's okay if you did. This is talking about what she has when she had the nechasim. This is talking about when she got the nechasim before she got married, and then she got married. Versus Rabbi Chananim ben Akavya said that she can chatzila sell them at that point. In that case. So, Rav Shmuel da Amitabai, so Rav and Shmuel both say differently. No, Ben Shenafel and Achasim Adshla Nisarisa, whether she inherited or whatever, whether she received the Nechasim before her Erosin, Ben Shenafel and Achasim Shenisarisa, Venisis, or she got the Nechasim after the Erosin and then she got married, either way, Habal Motzi Miyad Alakochas, and the husband is able to take away the property from those who bought it, which is different than our Mishnah. And the question is, come on, who is that like? The Loiker of Yehuda or the Loiker of Chananim and Akavya? That doesn't seem to be like either of the understandings in our Mishnah. The answer is, Inhu Da'amri Kirabi Seinu. Hello? Inhu Da'amri Kirabi Seinu. Rav and Shmuel are saying their din according to Rabbi Seinu. You're right, it's not one of the opinions in the Mishnah. It's another opinion. Rabbi Seinu is, Jodah Sotah Shonim explains that Rabbi Seinu is based in Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya, the grandson of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. The Tanya, as we learn in a Braisa, Rabbi Seinu chaz Rav Nimnu, Rabbi Seinu went and then voted on it and decided, Ben Shenafel Achle Tisarus, Ben Shenafel Mishne Tisarusa, exactly what they just said. Rabbi Seinu chaz Rav Nimnu, Ben Shenafel Achle Tisarus, whether she got the Nechasim before the Erosin, or Ben Shenafel Mishne Tisarusa, or whether she got them after the Erosin, Venisis, and then she got married, either way, Habal Moti Miyad Lakochas. So Rabbi Seinu are saying that, so Rav and Shmuel are entitled to follow that opinion rather than any of the opinions in the Mishnah. So the Ritva says, so why don't they just say halacha to Rabbi Seinu? And he says, because maybe the Chachamim, the Bnei HaYeshiva, didn't really know of the statement of Rabbi Seinu so well. So if they just said halacha to Rabbi Seinu, everybody would have said, what Rabbi Seinu? So like this, they stated the halacha to Rabbi Seinu. Then the Mishnah said, "B'shinisus elu ve'elu moedim," that if she gets the nechasim after she gets married, then everybody agrees that if she sells them, the husband is entitled to take them back. Elu ve'elu moedim she makar v'nasna shabal moedim yadal v'chus. The Mishnah said. The question is, "Lema tanina l'takonas osha." Does that mean then that our Mishnah is teaching us the din of takonas osha? Which we learned about before. The Amr of Yaisi Beb Chanina, when we learned about Tachanas Usha before on Dafnun, one of them was, B'usha Hiskinu, Ha'isha Shemachra B'nichsim Malog B'chayi Baila, that if a woman sold some of the Nichsim Malog while her husband was alive, Umesa, and then she died, Ha'bal Motzi Miyad Alakochas, that the husband's able to take it away from the buyers. Our Mishnah, the part of our Mishnah that talks about where she got Nechasim after she got married, seems to be recapping that. Which, okay, what's the problem with that? The one problem with it is that in that case, then what did Takanas Usha add? One way of looking at it is we're assuming that the Mishnah, we usually think of the Mishnah was written by Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi lived sometime after the Sanhedrin was in Usha. So if that's the case, then Takanas Usha would be before the Mishnah was written. But there's large parts of the Mishnah that actually go back to long before Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. There's parts of it that definitely are from the time of the second base of Mikdash. There's top parts of it that may be even earlier from Anshik Netzach Gerla. One possibility, some of Farshim explain, that the Gemara is assuming over here that the statement in our Mishnah comes from before Takanas Osha. So if that's the case, then the question is, what did Takanas Osha add? Or another way of looking at it is, even if we say that Takanas Usha came before the Mishnah, what we saw in our Mishnah, we had various opinions about it. We had Rav Gamliel's opinion, who disagrees with Takanas Usha. Why should we assume that the Stam Mishnah, which apparently Rav Gamliel would, at least, he may object to that, he may say, al-chadoshim anu-boshim, that we're embarrassed at the idea that we should, that this din should apply, but he's not disagreeing with it, per se. But if he had a Stam Mishnah that's going according to Takanas Usha, and he's saying that I disagree with Takanas Usha, so what is it?
what he's worth.
So that's part of the question is why, that's part of the question, how can we say that our Mishnah is telling us Takana Sosha? Because then it becomes uncertain, then it becomes kind of contradictory whether Rabban Gamliel disagrees with the Takana Sosha or not. The answer is, there is a difference. Masnissin b'chayer olaperis, the Mishnah is talking about while the woman is still alive, that she sold this property, the husband has the right to take this property back. Not in the sense of taking it back completely, after all, Nisim Malorga doesn't belong to him anyway. It means that he's still entitled to the payrus, so he's entitled to take it back in order to be able to continue eating the payrus. After she dies, though, then the guy who bought it is going to be entitled to it. That was before Takonas Osha. Takonas Osha begufa shokalko l'achamisa. Takonas Osha is something beyond that. That if she dies, then the husband is her yorish. Therefore,
even if there's lekuchas.
So therefore, even if there's a lekuchas, he's still considered to be the first buyer. So therefore, his ability to yarshin this land overrides the fact that somebody else had bought it, and therefore he'd be entitled to take the actual kalka away itself, or the actual kalka itself away after she dies. That's what Takana Sosha added.
Why did they add that?
Because there's the idea that we want that the husband should yarshin his wife.
He yarshins the whole deal, or if she wants to give it to her children.
If she wants to give it to her children, that's different. If she had a will or something, I mean, that's the same way as with a regular Yerusha. Yeah, you can. Yeah.
But she's a lady.
Okay, so.
She can give the karka.
The pashtus. I mean, the next thing we're going to talk about is a case of Havdracha, where she wants to keep the karka out of her husband's possession. That's a different matter, but yeah. The point is that Takanas Usha makes it that he's considered the first buyer. The earlier idea was that he's only considered a lekeach as far as the payrus. Now we're saying he's a lekeach as far as the gufa karka itself.
So why they didn't do Takanas even before she died?
Because before she dies, all he's entitled to is the payrus. That's the thing. The takana was that as long as there's a takana of payrus that he's entitled to payrus because in return for the fact that he redeems her. And then there's a separate takana, which is that he yarshins, if she dies before him, that he yarshins her.
Regarding the kuchas, that's the point.
That's the point, in other words.
So the kuchas
bought it, and
without knowledge.
So there is actually a machlokas we're showing him. When we say over here, habal moitzi miyad lekuchas, do we mean that they lose their money altogether, or do we mean the husband has to reimburse them? One way of looking at it is they bought it knowing that it's nichsim belug. They took their chances. And the fact is they still do have, there still is the possibility. Remember, we're talking over here if the husband outlives the wife. If it's the other way around, if the wife outlives the husband, then for sure the lekuchos are entitled to it. It doesn't become part of the husband's yerusha. Doesn't become part of his estate that goes to his children if he dies before her. So the lekuchos. So one possibility is that since they took their chance, they knew it was nichsim alum, they knew they're taking their chance, therefore they're not entitled to reimbursement. The other way of looking at it is maybe they are entitled to reimbursement. He pays them back what they paid for it.
If she dies, they have to pay him for the job.
That's what I'm saying. There's a machlokes we're showing him on that point.
Why would do such a thing?
Because you're taking a risk. You're taking a risk. But you know what? Forget stolen goods. For example, we had earlier in the Masechta, and we're going to have later on in the Tzaddiks, we're going to have various cases where a woman sells her ksuba. When you get down to it, that's also the same kind of thing. It's also a risk. If she dies before her husband, then the buyers don't get anything. If she dies after her husband, she's entitled to a ksuba, and then they get it. So it's one of those things. It's like playing the stock market or something. You know, you might get back your investment. You might get back much more than your investment. You might lose it all. You know. Yeah. There are people who like to gamble. You know. Then we said in the Mishnah, Rav Shimon Cholek Bein Nechasim. Rav Shimon differentiates between Nechasim that were known versus Nechasim that were not known. where he says that if they, the Mishnah had said, that Reb Shimon had said, if the Nechasim were known to a husband, then she can't sell them, and if she does, then the sale is bottled, the sale is ineffective, as opposed to if the husband didn't know about them, then the sale, then she shouldn't, but if she did, then what's done is done. So, Elohen Yidruin, Ve'Elohen Shein Yidruin, what's considered known property, what's considered unknown. Amar Rav Yosi Ve'Chanina, Yidruin Mekauki, Shein Yidruin Metautlin. What's considered known property is karka, because karka can't be hidden. If she owns land, there's no way of hiding it.
How would the people know?
She inherited or whatever, she somehow came into possession of this property. We're saying the very fact that it's real estate, which can't be moved, makes it nechasim yiduin. It's considered the husband automatically knows about it. Because the point is, when he married her, he knew that she has this property. People generally know who owns what piece of land.
Generally.
Therefore, he married her, Rashi says, he married her having in mind those nechasim. He was expecting, therefore, that they're going to become part of the marital, part of the marital assets. And therefore, if she sells them, then michra batel. Then the sale is ineffective. On the other hand, she'en yidruin metaltelin. What's not known would be metaltelin. Metaltelin can easily be hidden away. He may not have known that she owns these metaltelin.
Let me ask you a simple question. She had karka in another town. He didn't know that.
Wait. That's the other opinion. We have two opinions over here. This is Rabbi Yosi ben Chanina's opinion, that any kind of karka, regardless of the location, is considered yidruin. Rabbi Yechanan Amar, Eluv Elu Yiduin Hein. Rabbi Yechanan says no. Either Kauka or Metaltelin is considered known. The Elu Hein Shein Yiduin. What's considered property that's not known? Koshi Yeshevis Kan Benafel on the Chasim of Medina Sayam. When she's living in one place and she inherits property in Medina Sayam. There are actually different opinions among the Mefarshim whether literally we mean Medina Sayam or not. Maybe like you're saying, you could say it specifically means Medina Sayam, because he didn't even know that she has somebody to inherit from over there. So therefore it was completely unexpected. And therefore we're saying he didn't have anything on it in mind, and therefore b'dievet if she sells, then fine. The other way of looking at it, it doesn't necessarily mean Medina Sayam. It could even be it's local, but it's somebody that he didn't know that she stands to inherit from.
Different city.
It could even be in the same city. He didn't know that her great great uncle is Bill Gates, and that he doesn't have any other any other heirs. You know. Yeah.
Bill Gates, he probably wouldn't know.
Yeah. Come on. Okay. Fine. Okay. Tanya Namid Hachi, we learn similarly in Braisa, Elohen She'en Yiduin, what's considered property that's unknown, Koshi Yeshevet Kandra, Nafalon Nechasim Medina Sayam. If she's living here and she receives Nechasim Medina Sayam. So the Gemara tells now of a case that bears on this issue of Nechasim that are Yiduin or She'en and Yiduin. Hahi, it says, Deboya de Tiberchinu Lenichsa Megabra. This, a certain woman, when Rashi says she was an Almana, she was going to get remarried, she had property. I guess that she had Yarshin from her first husband or whatever. She wanted to keep this property out of the hands of her husband. She ultimately, what's going to happen? We're saying that if she brings it into the marriage and then she dies, then the husband is the one who inherits it. She didn't want it. She wanted it instead to go to her daughter. She wanted to keep it out of her husband's reach. So therefore, Tisaktinu Librata, so she wrote out a shtamatana saying that she's giving them to her daughter. Now Rashi and Tosfos argue over here, what exactly did she do over here? Rashi says she actually told the Edim that I don't really mean this to be an absolute matana, an irrevocable gift. I'm only doing this in order to keep it out of my husband's hands. But if it should happen that my husband dies before me or divorces me, then I want it back. So it's a condition. According to Rashi, she told the Edim that this is only a conditional gift. Tosfos argues with that on a number of grounds, including that the next sugya, the sugya over here, we're going to be discussing whether, in fact, the daughter is entitled to hold on to the property or not. I mean, if she actually flat out told the Edim this isn't meant as a real gift, then why would there even be a havam in that the daughter could keep it? So therefore, Tosfos says that different, that it's not, she didn't actually say so in so many words to the Edim, but you could tell by the situation, you could tell that she was only doing it for this purpose, not because she really wanted to give it away permanently.
The matana, the dina of matana, she can take it back whenever she wants?
Well, there is such a thing as matana amanas lahachzir, but in this case, she didn't specifically say amanas lahachzir, that's
right.
The thing. She did, what she did over here is, according to Rashi, what she did over here is basically what's called a maida. where you're making a declaration beforehand. Yes, I'm selling or giving or whatever this is, but I'm not really doing this as meant to be a binding thing. I'm only doing this for appearances' sake, basically. According to Tosfos, she didn't actually say that in so many words, but it's a case where you could tell looking at the situation that it's obvious she's not giving it away just because she still wants to give her daughter a present. She's obviously doing it for this reason. So, sure enough, in Siva v'Igarsha, she got married and then later she got divorced. Asoy l'kameh d'Rav Nachman, so she came to Rav Nachman. I need my daughter to return me this field. Whereas the daughter says, wait a minute, I have a shtar saying that you gave it to me as a present. Karei Rav Nachman l'shtara. Rav Nachman ripped up the shtar. To say, in other words, it's true, then the matana is no matana, you're not entitled to keep it, it goes back to your mother. Also Rav Onan, the Kamei de Ma'ukva. So Rav Onan, one of the other Chachamim, goes to Ma'ukva. Amalai Chazimar, Rebbe, look, Nachman Chakla, Nachman the Chakla literally means like the person, but sort of like a farmer or like a person from a hick town or something like that. Rashi says, Eni Baki Bidin. He's somebody who doesn't know the din. Hechim Mikra, yeah, the farmer. Hechim Mikra, Shari de Inshi. How are you talking? He's ripping up people's status. Amalai. So Ma'ukva, and now why is he going complaining to Ma'ukva? So Rashi says Ma'ukva was found based in. So therefore he's the one who's supposed to be in charge of these kinds of things. Amalai, so Ma'ukva tells him, okay, Emily, easy. Tell me, easy. Easy, there's two possibilities what it means. Rashbam on a pasuk, on a pasuk in Parshat Toldos, where it's a mi eifoi who atzad sayid. Rashi explains over there that eifoi is like an extra word in the sentence. Who then was it? So Rashbam says that easy is the same kind of thing in Aramaic. So Emily, easy means like, okay, so tell me, so then tell me. The other possibility is that easy means my friend. Tell me, my friend, gufadov de hechehava. What's the whole story over here? What's the backstory over here? Omalei hachava hechehava. So the bottom tells him the whole story. Omalei, so Ma'okva tells him, that's different. Shtar mavrachas kamret. So you're talking, this isn't a regular shtar matana. This is a shtar of a matana that was meant just in order to for evasion purposes. For evading, bringing it into the marriage. That's different. Hachi amar abchani loy bar idi amashmur. You should know, Rav Chaniloi Bar Idi said in the name of Shmuel, Moira Hirani, I am a Moira Hira, which means Rashi says, I have permission from the Reish Galusa to judge Dinim Omenis, meaning, in other words, that I'm a Baki. And Im Yovei Shtar Mavrachas L'Yodi Ekra'enu, and if a Shtar Mavrachas comes to my hand, I will rip it up. So yes, you have the example of Shmuel, who said that he would do the same thing. So don't object to the fact that Nachman is doing it. A couple of different details over here. First of all, some of the Rishonim say that instead the Girsa, the Ritva says, the Girsa is not Moira Harani, but rather, let me start with first. The Maram Shif says, what's the point of him introducing it by saying Moira Harani? Given that Rav Onan had claimed that Rav Nachman is Chakla, a farmer who doesn't know the dinim, so he's telling him, you should know, Shmuel was obviously not a farmer, he was a Moira Hira, he was an expert on the dinim, and he said the same thing. However, there are other Rishonim who say, I think the Ritva says, that the word is not Moira Hirani, but Miyire Hirani. I'm somebody, Shmuel saying, who usually is afraid to set new precedents in Halacha. Nevertheless, I know the halacha in this case, and that is that a shtar mavrachas can just be ripped up. That's worthless. We start up in the middle of Ein Chayim.
He's not setting new precedent with Shmuel.
No, Shmuel himself is saying. Usually I would be nervous about setting new precedents like this, but in this case, I know for a fact that this is how it should be. Yeah. We're holding on Ein Testament Aleph, if you want from the top. Interesting thing over here the Chofetz Chaim talks about in Hilchos Lashon Hara about, so what do we have here? Rav Onan is complaining about, right? Is complaining to the Reish Galusa about Rav Nachman. He says it's not a problem of Lashon Hara because Rav Onan is not just going to try and tattletale on Rav Nachman. He's concerned the halacha is being applied incorrectly. That's a valid reason to tell it. And we see the Chofetz Chaim adds, you see something like this. Towards the end of the Masechta, in about a month, the Gemara is going to tell about how this same Rav Onan used to have Gilui Eliyahu. So he was a great person. Nevertheless, Ma'ukva tells him, I hear what you're saying. You're accusing Rav Nachman of not knowing the dinim. I want to hear the whole story. I'm not just going to take you at your word. I need to hear the whole story. And sure enough, when he hears the whole story, he's telling Rav Onan that you see Rav Nachman was right after all. So therefore, you see from that, even when you hear something from an Adam Gadol, check the backstory. There may be more than there may be more here than meets the eye.
I don't think this Gemara had a lot of sharp words.
Yeah. Okay. Amalei Rava L'Rav Nachman. So Rava asks Rav Nachman. So you're telling me then, you're saying that you can rip up the shtar, that it's worthless, the matana is no matana. But wait a minute. Time am I? When you think about it, what's the logical reason? We should assume that a person is not going to give away something from themselves and just leave it for somebody else. In other words, here, if this is, you know, a person's not going to take a field and just give it as a matana, you know, irrevocably, and then deny themselves of it. So then, hani milu lachrini. Well, then logically, shouldn't that apply only if it's going to somebody else, to a friend or somebody outside the family? Aval levrata yahiva. But couldn't you argue that maybe a person is willing to give a matana irrevocably to their child? So yes, this is to her daughter. Maybe you should assume it was a valid matana. Why are you saying why are you using Shmuel's precedent and saying no, a shtam avrachas is a shtam avrachas, and let's rip it up?
But she had the intent of making it escape her husband.
We know that, but the argument is that maybe it's different. If you're using a shtam avrachas to give it to some other person, to some third party that's not related to you, Mela, okay, it's obvious that you're only doing it for evasion. But if you're giving it to your daughter, maybe it's genuinely meant to be a matana, and now the mother just changed her mind, and you can't change your mind with that kind of thing.
No other people you're thinking of.
The answer is, yes, but that's true, but even so, true, but on the other hand, she'd still prefer for herself over for her daughter. Yes, a person would give a matana to their child, but it's more logical to assume that as much as possible, they would want to try to keep it for themselves. Yes, she wants to be magriach from her husband, but not at the cost that she's going to lose it entirely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, at this point, when she gave it to the daughter, she was married, but yes.
But then she got divorced,
right. Basically, the Gemara says, no, she wasn't planning on getting divorced. She just did it in case she does, yeah. Basically, the Gemara says, I have a contradiction. But Isaac says, if a woman, Taka, wants to make, to evade her nechasim going to her husband, so what should she do? She should write a shtar pasim to somebody else. What's shtar pasim? We learned about it. We learned that concept earlier in the Masechta around Daf Chof. A shtar pasim basically, so Rashi says it means like this. Pasim is Meloshin pius. You talk the person into it. You say to this person, yes, I'm giving you a shtar that shows that I'm giving you this property as a matana. Please don't actually try to claim based on it. Realize that I'm only giving it to you for appearance's sake, and do me a favor and don't go to Beis Din afterwards and say, you know what, I'm entitled to keep it. No, of course not. I mean, it's sort of, you're asking the person, do me a favor. Yes, I'm giving you a shtar that you would legally be able to go to Beis Din and claim that it's yours. Yes, putting it under your name. Yeah. But do me a favor and don't do that, please. That's called shtar passing. We learned earlier in the Masechta that Edom are not supposed to sign on a shtar pasim, right? So in fact, because that's the thing. We said before that Edom are not supposed to sign on a shtar pasim anyway. That's for that reason, the Rashba talks about that maybe what the Gemara means here is not literally a shtar pasim, but just sort of in that sense. So it would be similar to what we said before that either according to Rashi, she actually goes and tells the Edom that this isn't meant as a real gift, or according to Tosfos that. It's obvious from the circumstances. So it's not a real shtar pasim in the sense of I'm giving you the shtar, but I'm asking you not to collect on it. It would be illegal for the agent to sign on that. But rather, we mean it's like a shtar pasim in the sense that it's not actually meant to be used.
The witnesses see it happen, but no one signed it.
No, they do sign it, but they sign it. But that's the thing. According to Rashi, she told them that I'm only doing this for appearance's sake, slavriach, and therefore, when the thing comes to Beis Din, the agent can say that yeah, that's what she told us. According to Tosfos, in that case, there wouldn't even be a Habam in it to say otherwise. It has to be that we're talking about you look at the circumstances. When Beis Din will ask the Edom, what were the circumstances when this Shtar Matana was written? And they would say it was a week before her wedding. And then Beis Din would say, you know what, in that case, it's obvious that it was meant as a Shtar Avracha. Anyway, Divrei Rav Shimon Gamliel, that's what Rav Shimon Gamliel says. You write the Shtar Pasim. Vachachamim, the Chacham say that won't work. Rotza Matzachek Bar. Actually, if you write, even if you write the Shtar Pasim, the buyer, if he, not the buyer, the recipient of the gift, if he wants, Matzachek Bar, he can laugh at her. He can say, you know what, very nice, but I have a Shtar. It says that I own this property. So tough luck. How do you work it then? The Chachamim say, Ad shetichtev lo mahayom uch she'erza. She has to write on the Shtar as follows. This gift is pending. It takes effect as of today if I want it. So therefore, until she actually, so it's a machlokes of showing him whether she actually has to say I want it or whether she has to just not say I don't want it to take effect. Whatever it is, when so either if, you know, a month or year or whatever it is later she says I want or she doesn't come to Beis Din and protest it or whatever, as the case may be, then it's retroactively been the guy's all along. As opposed to, if not, but it's still pending until Lushatirza. If she wants to object to it, or to not confirm it, then the Matana won't take effect. The Chum say that's the only way it works.
Does she have to share it? It's a Tanai, basically.
It's basically a Tanai, yeah. So therefore, time under Kasva Lahachi, so we see why does that work, according to the Chachamim, only because she actually wrote that. Which implies that if she doesn't write like that, then the Lekeach will actually acquire it. So how is Shmuel and then Reb Nachman also saying that the shtar is no shtar and you rip it up according to this braisa? It comes out that yes. So okay, the Gemara could have answered that they go according to Reb Shimon Gamliel, but okay, Reb Shimon Gamliel versus the Chachamim Yochid versus Rabim, we shouldn't assume that halacha is like Reb Shimon Gamliel with Pashas, that halacha is like the Chachamim. The answer is Amar Reb Zera like Kasha Haba Kula Haba Miktsasa. There's two different possibilities. There could be where she wrote in this shtar matana all of her nechasim versus some of them. If she wrote all of them, then like you said, she needs something to live off of. It's more likely to assume that she didn't really mean it as a genuine matana. Therefore, Shmuel is saying, even if she didn't write mehayom l'chsherza, we should assume that that's the case. It wasn't meant as a genuine shtar matana. It was only meant for appearances, and therefore rip it up. Therefore, the matana is not matana.
If it was,
that's what she did with Kula. As opposed to if she did the miktsasa, if she only gave away some of her property, well, it's reasonable enough. She might have, she left something for herself and she gave some of it away to her daughter or a friend or whatever it is. So then we should assume that's what the Braisa is saying. The Chachamim are saying that if she wants that to not be in effect, then she has to write Mahayom Lukhsheritza. If she doesn't write that, then Mitzachas brother, then he can laugh at her and say, you know what, I got a nice piece of property for free. One more question then. V'i loy kanani lekeach nikninu baal. Going back to the case before of the shtar matana, where according to Reb Nachman and then according to Shmuel, where we said it's not really a shtar matana and then you rip it up. So then, in that case, what did we say? We seem to have said all this time that the havracha worked. This property did not become part of the marital assets, therefore the husband wasn't entitled to pay us from it. And now we're saying that we undo that matana, the matana was no matana, and therefore she's entitled to it back. Well, you're contradicting yourself. If you're saying the matana was no matana, the lakeach never acquired it, in this case the daughter, then the husband acquired it. Then the havracha was no havracha. So how did that even help at all? You should retroactively say the husband was entitled to pay us from it all this time and have to reimburse him for it. Why doesn't the husband acquire it? The answer is, Amar Abaya, Asom k'nechasim sheni yidurin labal. Because in this case, we treat it like the case that Reb Shimon had said in our Mishnah, of property that's not known to the husband. Because the husband didn't know that she owns it at the time. It was given away as a matana. He thought it was a genuine matana. So he never knew of it. He never expected to get paid from it in the first place. He never, when he married her, he didn't have in mind that this is going to be part of her property. Valid Reb Shimon. And according to Reb Shimon, then we say that v'di'evet, if she sells it, then it's valid. So in this case, v'di'evet, she gave it away. Because he didn't know. That's what we're saying. Nechasim you're doing, or sheni you're doing. That's what we, just like we said before, that if it's in Medina Sayyam, that if it's in either literally in Medina Sayyam or just some completely unexpected relative, then we said that's when Reb Shimon is saying, according to Reb Yochanan, it's Nechasim sheni you're doing, and she shouldn't sell them l'chatchila, but v'di'evet, if she did, then fine. Same thing over here.
So that's just according to Reb Shimon.
Tosfos points out that evidently then we see from our Gemara that the halacha is like Reb Shimon, and that is in fact the case.
He finds out in between.
Okay, but he found out in between. But too bad. At the time, it was the chasim sheni you're doing. Yeah. There is. There, having said that, there, hello. There is a pretty big machlokas rishonim on the sugya over here. What in the end is the final halacha? Do we say that the lekeach or the mekabel is entitled to keep the property? Or do we say that not? That in fact she's entitled to it back? Or do we say maybe, and if we say she's entitled to it back, is the lekeach at least entitled to hold on to the payrus that they got all this time, or do they have to reimburse her for those also? Different opinions. Different opinions among the rishonim. The halacha in Shulchan Aruch is, if I remember correctly, that in fact she is entitled to get it back. The shtar is no shtar, and she's entitled to the payrus back as well. I think. I don't remember about that detail. But... Now, so the basic idea we were saying is that the woman's nechassim that she brings into the marriage, the nichsim log, that is, the husband is entitled to payrus from them. But now this Mishnah is going to discuss what happens if she has payrus themselves, if she has things that basically, how do we make it that he's going to be able to always have payrus from her nechassim? For nechassim, if she has property, sure, then you have the payrus that grow in it. If it's a house or whatever, you rent it out, etc. What about various other kinds of things? So, not a lot of him. So, if she inherits money, then what we do is we use that money to buy land, and the land belongs to her, and the payrus he gets. As opposed to, the point is, we don't say we give him the money to invest, and he'll have the payrus that way. He'll have the profits from the investment, because there's too much of a chance that the money, the investment may go sour. He'll go and buy somebody else's silver or whatever, and then end up losing all his money. You don't want that. You want to make sure that the keren is preserved for her. Peiros ha'tlushin min hakarka. What happens if she inherited fruit or produce that's already detached from the ground, so it's metaltalin? Same thing. Yilochach ben karka v'oichal peiros. Again, use that. You sell that fruit. Use it to buy a plot of land, and he'll eat the peiros from that plot of land. No, but so it depends on the amounts we're talking about. I mean,
he's talking about a ton of grain.
Okay, so you know, yeah. and you know what? Fine, so you use it to buy one square inch of office space in that. You can make it. You know. What about Peter Samchobar Bakaka? What if she inherits fruit that's still attached to the ground? So what do you do? Amar Meir, you do like this. Shamin Oisa, you figure out the value of the field. Kamehi yofa b'peiros, how much is the field worth with the fruit still attached? Kamehi yofa b'loi peiros versus how much is it worth once the fruit has been picked? That difference in price is considered to be his. Umoiso, so the difference in price, you look up ben kaka v'oichal peiros. You use that to buy property and he'll eat the peiros. The point is that we figure like this, Rashi says. You have to distinguish with the food. You have to distinguish between it grew up until now out of his rishus. Now, from now on, it's going to be growing in his rishus. How do you estimate that difference in value? That's how. You figure out the difference between a field that's full of grain versus a field that's not. And that's the value that's considered to be his. Yeah. So the karka itself, the karka itself for sure belongs to her. That's definitely keren. But the field itself without anything is worth 1,000. The field with a whole crop in it is worth 1,500. So that 500 is considered to be, yeah.
And if it changes over time?
We're talking about how much it is right now. Right now, when it comes into the marriage. Any fruit that's still attached to the ground when she inherited it automatically becomes his. As opposed to the produce that's already detached from the ground, shalot, and that belongs to her, and therefore since it belongs to her, then you follow the usual rule, you lock up ben karka, royal peiros, you buy karka with it, and he eats the peiros. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Rabbi Shimon says, you do like this. In the case where he's better off, where he gets an advantage when the asset comes into the marriage, that same kind of case, he's worse off, he loses out when she leaves the marriage, meaning if he divorces her. What do we mean, in other words? If the fruit is attached to the ground when she inherits the property, then it's considered his. Then it's considered his payers. As opposed to, if it was the same kind of thing in reverse, they get divorced, and right now she owns a piece of property with payers still attached to the ground, we say those payers belong to her. So he has the advantage when it comes into the marriage, when it comes to attached payers, and those attached payers is at a disadvantage when the marriage is over. On the other hand, and vice versa, the case where he's worse off, where he loses out when it comes into the marriage, namely if the fruit is detached, he gains those when she leaves. I mean, same idea. In other words, if the field had at the time when she inherited it, it had a stack of already harvested grain in it, for example, then he's not entitled to it. It's considered hers, and therefore we say that you use that fruit to buy karka, and he gets only the payers of that. Conversely, though, if when he divorces her, at the time she has a stack of grain in one of her fields, then he's entitled to that grain because it's considered payers. Ketzad, what does this mean exactly? Like we just said, payers am chuborim lakarka, fruit that's still attached to the ground, the knisasa shaloi, when it comes into the marriage, it's considered his, or vitsiasa shaloi, but when she gets divorced, then it's considered hers. If it's detached from the ground, then when it comes into the marriage, it's considered hers because it's detached from the ground, and therefore he has no particular, he has rights to the papers for that, but not to the keren of it. When she goes out, then the fruit itself belongs to him because it's part of his papers. So the Gemara starts off. Now the Mishnah had said that if she inherits money, we said you buy with it karka and he eats payers. When you get down to it, you don't necessarily have to say you buy karka. There's a lot of possibilities that you could buy something that will generate an income. So the first thing that Gemara is going to talk about over here is a couple of possibilities. What's the preferred thing to buy? Pshita, it's obvious that ara ubati, if they have the choice, one of them wants to buy land with this money for planting, the other one wants to buy a house. Ara, then we say that the one who wants to buy the land has the advantage. We go according to what they want. Why? Because Rashi says the logic is the logic is like this. On the one hand, a field has an advantage because you can get you can get a lot more income out of it every year it produces crops. A house maybe not necessarily so much, especially if you don't find somebody to rent it out to. On the other hand, a field lasts pretty much forever. A house eventually falls down. But we're saying that therefore the advantages of a field are greater than the advantages of a house. And therefore we say go ahead, whichever one wants to buy the field is the one that we go according to that. Bati vidikli, what if one of them wants to buy a house and the other one wants to buy a palm tree? Then we say bati, then the preferred thing is a house. Because a house has an advantage. A house lasts much longer than a palm tree. A palm tree may dry up and then you have nothing. You have no care in it at all. A house tends to last a lot longer than that. Dikli ve'iloni, what if you have palm trees versus other kinds of trees? Then dikli. Then the preferred thing is to buy palm trees because they need less cultivation than other trees. There's less work that you have to put into them than other kinds of trees. No, actually they produce a lot more pears. Dates, one palm tree produces a lot of dates. Iloni the gufni, what if you have the question of buying regular trees versus grapevines? Iloni, then you say trees, because again, grapevines require a lot of maintenance and they don't last as long. Tosfos points out that actually you have grapevines. You can earn a lot more income from grapevines because a grapevine will produce a lot more grapes than a palm tree will produce dates, and the grapes sell for a lot more. But it also takes a lot of work. So therefore, better to do the palm tree, where you have maybe less profits, but also less work. A lot of these regular trees, as opposed to oranges, apples, and yeah.
Yeah.
What about Abba Zrata Upera de Kavri? What if you have the what if you want to buy Abba Zrata, Rashi says, means a forest full of Zrata trees. Zrata is Rashi says that Zrata Ilanus Cholo Zrata, Rashi says. In English it's called a sorb tree. It's a tree. It's mainly used for its wood. It produces little fruit, little apple shaped fruit. Nothing particularly valuable. The fruit is not terribly important. They're mainly used as a tree for wood. So that, or pera de cabri, or a fish pond. So what would be the din with those? Do we consider those to be? There's two ways of looking at it. You can say that those are considered a keren, or you can say that those are considered peris. So what we do is. Amri la Peira va Amri la Kama. There's two different opinions. One way of looking at it is that this forest or this fish pond are considered Peiras, because you consider maybe that the land itself is the Keren, and the trees or the fish are considered the Peiras. The one way of looking at it is you say that itself is considered Peiras, in which case, since the husband doesn't get Peiras of Peiras, then what you do is you sell the trees or you sell the fish and use that to buy more land, and the husband gets paid out of that. I'm Lakana, others say that it's considered Karen, and therefore he just gets the payers of that. The other way around. If we consider it Karen, the reason why we consider it Karen is because when you chop down the trees, they don't grow back. When you catch the fish, there's no more fish. So maybe therefore we should consider it a Karen. And there won't be any payers anymore. Maybe therefore we should sell the whole. So that's the thing. If we consider it Karen, then we have to sell the whole thing and buy something that will produce payers. As opposed to if we say that it's considered payers, then the husband just gets the payers. Klala de Milsa, the general rule is Gizei Machlef Peira. If it's something that will regrow, Gizei Machlef literally means the tree, that the trunk will grow back. Peira, then we consider it payers. And Gizei Machlef Kana, if it doesn't regenerate, then, today was Earth Day, sustainable versus unsustainable, renewable versus non-renewable resources. If it's renewable, then it's Peiras. If it's non-renewable, then it's Karen. So, for example, the forest is non-renewable. You chop down the trees, and they don't regenerate. Having said that, though, if you manage it like they manage forests nowadays, maybe that's different. But actually, the Rashba has a different explanation of Abba Zrata. He says that it means a place where reeds, like bamboo or whatever, grow. In that case, it is Gizei Machlef. It keeps on regenerating. Tosfos, by the way, has mentioned a couple of different possible Birsois. Over here, it might be the other way around, that if Gizei Machlef, then it's considered Keren, and if not, then it's considered Peiras. And Tosfos has a whole different understanding of this issue anyway. We're not talking about the basic question, are they considered Peiras or are they considered Keren? It's rather the question of if one of them wants to buy this forest, or one of them wants to buy this fish pond, is that considered a valid use of the money that she inherited? Is that considered a valid use of something that you're buying a Karen, which then he's going to get paid us out of? Well, according to Rashi, the question is that what you can go ahead. She inherited. According to Rashi, we're talking about she inherited the forest. The question is whether it's considered paid us or Karen. Tosfos is saying that no. The question is she inherited money. You want to invest that money in something. Is one or the other of them entitled to say, let's go invest it in a forest? Is that considered Karen, in which case the husband can get payers from it, or is it considered payers and then not? That's the way of looking at it. So then the question would be whether it gives a machlif or ain't gives a machlif, whether it's renewable or non-renewable. So no, today you would say a forest is renewable because that's how they manage them nowadays. But it may also depend on what kind of trees. I mean, we mentioned over here specifically Zrata. I don't know. I'm not familiar enough with how Zrata trees grow. Maybe they're the type where once you chop them down, at the end of it. I don't know. Amar Rab Zera, Amar Rab Oshia, Amar Rab Yanai. The Amri La Amar Rab Zera, Amar Abba, Amar Rab Oshia, Amar Rab Yanai. So it's Rab Zera or Rab Abba, the last one in the chain. Anyway, he says, I'm going to Vlad Behemoth Malug. What if somebody steals the baby of an animal which is part of Nichsim Malug? So the wife inherited an animal, so it becomes Nichsim Malug. She owns the animal itself. The husband is entitled to the payers, the wool, the milk, etc. he's also entitled to the babies that are born from it, because those are part of the payers as well. Somebody stole that baby. So we say Mishalom Tashlumei Kefil LeIsha. Who does he pay the double payment to? He pays it to the wife. Which actually, so I was just saying that the husband is entitled to the children as part of payers. Actually, based on this, so far it sounds like not. So far it sounds like the Vlad is considered part of the Keren, and that's why it goes to her rather than to him. The question is, Kaman, who is that like? Like Rabbanan, but like Hananya. That seems to be neither like the Rabbanan nor like Hananya in this brayso that we're going to quote, the Tanya. Vlad behemoth malug v'bal, the baby of the animal of nichsa malug belongs to the husband. Whereas Vlad shifchas malug l'isha, whereas the baby of a shifcha, that's part of nichsa malug, belongs to the woman. That's the Rabbanan. But Hananya ben achiyoshi ama osu Vlad shifchas malug, ki Vlad behemoth malug. No, the same. The two of them are the same thing. If the animal is considered, if the Vlad of the animal belongs to the husband, so does the Vlad of the shifcha. Either way, both of them are saying that the Vlad of the animal definitely belongs to the husband. So why are you saying over here that the Shlum and Kefil should go to the woman? The answer is, you could say it goes according to everybody, because the difference is Peira Takino Le Rabbanan. The Rabbanan made a Takana that the husband is entitled to Peiras from his wife's property. Peira Le Takino Le Rabbanan. They did not make a Takana that he gets Peiras of Peiras. Namely, if we consider, let's say, for example, that, fine, let's consider this Vlad really is considered Peiras. Therefore, the husband's entitled to it, both Rabbanan and Hananya are both saying that. But the kefil, the tashlumei kefil, is peiros of peiros. It's only coming about because the vlad was stolen, and therefore he's having to pay the ganav is having to pay this extra amount. Tosfos makes the distinction: what's the difference between peiros versus peiros of peiros? Because the fact is, we're going to learn in the next parak, the husband is entitled to peiros of peiros. That what we mean over here by peiros of peiros, Tosfos says, means we're talking about that the peiros are coming from completely out of left field, like. You know, here, Paris of Paris means, for example, that the Vlad eventually grows up and has babies of its own. That's the normal way of doing things. This Paris of Paris that we're talking about over here, it's not normal that an animal is stolen and then the ganav gets caught and he pays tashlum kefil. That's because that's not the kind of Paris of Paris that the husband is entitled to. That's why we're saying it goes to the wife instead. Tosfos also discusses the question, what about when we say the kefil?
Paris already expected Paris.
Basically the expected Paris, right. Other Rishonim learn differently. That there is a difference between that. There's a difference. Yeah. Tosfos also discusses the question. By the way, we're saying the woman gets kefil. What about the actual payment for the keren? Does that go to the husband or does that go to the wife? So the Gemara asks, Bishlam l'Chananya. Okay, I can understand why Chananya is saying in both cases that we consider that the Vlad belongs to the husband, that we don't consider we consider it part of the Peiros, in other words, rather than part of the Keren. He figures the Leichashin and Lamisa. He figures we're not concerned that the original animal is going to die. In other words, we would think as follows. The Chachamim are saying, why are we saying that the Vlad should be considered part of Keren? The whole point is we want to preserve the Keren for the wife. Logically, we should say, what if the mother animal dies, then the wife is going to be left without a keren at all. Logically, therefore, we would want to say that the vlad stands in place of the mother and therefore it's considered part of the keren, and that way she's always guaranteed a keren. So according to Hananya, we can understand. He's not concerned about that. He's not concerned that the animal or the shifcha is going to die, and therefore, as long as they're not dead, then the vlad is considered a peiros. El Rabbanan, but according to the Rabbanan, why are they being inconsistent? If they're concerned about the possibility of the mother dying after the Vlad behemoth malug nami, then the same thing, even the Vlad of the animal should also not be considered, should go to her, it should be considered part of the Keren. And if they're not concerned about Misa, after the Vlad Shivcha's not malug nami, then the same thing should apply to the Vlad Shivcha. Why are we saying that goes to the husband? Why are we saying that goes to the wife and not the vlad of animal? Yeah. The answer is la'olam chai shi l'misa. No, you could say that indeed the chachamim are concerned about the possibility of misa. V'shaini behemah de'ika ora. It's different though in the case of an animal, because even if the mother animal dies, the keren is not completely lost. The wife still has the skin of the animal. That's worth something. So the keren is not completely lost. As opposed to the shifcha, you can't use the skin of a shifcha, which, by the way, actually is actually not so simple. There are a number of Rishonim that talk about this issue. The hair is something else, but there is actually a bit of a discussion. Are you in fact allowed to use the skin? Is the skin of a shivcha, who's after all not a full-fledged Jew, is it also b'hana or not? They quote, in fact, the Tosfos on Bava Kamma that seems to imply that maybe it's not also b'hana. And there's a couple of different possible answers, one of them being that, yes, maybe it's not technically also b'hana, but practically speaking, who's going to use it? You know, I mean, you hear of in horror movies people that use human skin for things. You know, it's not in real life people don't do it. Other possibilities are maybe it's mutter mizaraisa, but it's also midrabanan. Maybe that's one possibility. That's good. Yeah. So therefore, so the point is, in the case of an animal, there is always guaranteed to still be a keren. Therefore, let the husband have the vlad. Let it be considered part of payment. As opposed to with the shivcha, when she dies, there's nothing that's left that the wife is going to be able to keep and then maybe be able to use. Therefore, let her keep the vlad. That's what the chacham is saying. If who has children?
The shivcha.
That's what they were talking about, vlad shivcha. That's exactly what we're talking about, the children. Okay, Amar Rav Huna bar Chiya Amar Shmuel, halacha kechananya. The halacha, in fact, is like Chananya, so therefore we say both of them are considered, both of them belong to the husband. We're not concerned about Mesa. Amar Rav, Amar Rav Nachman, afa gavda Amar Shmuel, halacha kechananya, even though Shmuel is saying the halacha is like Chananya, moide Chananya, she misgarsha, but Chananya does agree that if this woman ends up getting divorced, neisenes damim v'netlasa, that she has the right to pay the husband for these vladers, and then take them back. Because you want the reputation of her father's house, as we're going to learn in the next Mishnah, that it increases. It we learned about this in Yevamos as well. That it makes her family. It increases the reputation and the good name of her family when they have that they have a vadim that belongs to them. Some Farshim say we're also talking about the animals over here. That it increases shvach beisavia, that there is an estate, that there's actual things that she got from them and that eventually go back into the family. So therefore, the husband, in other words, doesn't have the right to say, you know what, these vladers were considered mine as part of payers, therefore I get to keep them permanently. No, if she wants to pay for them and get them back, she's entitled to them. We learned a similar concept in Yevamos about things that she brought into the not, and the same idea. Shvach beisavia. It's better. Her family would rather have these actual objects, sort of like when you have an heirloom or something. You know, you'd rather have the actual object back rather than just the value of it.
At that point, shvach beisavia counts so much.
It counts so much. Yeah, that's what we're saying. Just like for that, we talked about in Yevamos in connection, for example, where she brings like heirloom kalim or whatever into the marriage, that she's entitled to have those actual kalim back. Yeah, even though that was, we were actually talking about nichsitza and barzel, where the husband has full rights to them, he just has to reimburse her at the end. But if they actually still exist, shvach beisavia says that she's entitled to them back because it's good for her family and for their reputation that they get to keep their heirlooms. Yeah. Amar Rava, Amar Rav Nachman, hichnisa lo eiz l'chalava. What if she brought into the marriage a goat that he's entitled to the milk, v'rocha l'gizasa, or a sheep for the wool, v'tanagolos l'beitzasa, or a chicken for the eggs, v'deka l'peroisav, or a palm tree for the fruit. He can go ahead and continue eating and then using the milk or the wool or whatever until the keren is used up, meaning in other words, until the animal dies or the tree dries up or whatever. Eventually, the animal dies. Eventually. No, but that's the point over here. Even if it never has, even if the animal never gives birth to any other young,
yeah.
So fine. At some point, it dies. We don't say it. That we don't say that. We say that he's entitled to keep on doing it. She doesn't have a keren, she'll have whatever's left. The skin of the animal or whatever, if necessary, is the keren, the firewood left over from the tree.
If the animal has blood,
that's what we said before. The blood is a payers. Having said that, though, there is a machlokus between Rashi and most of the other Rishonim, what we mean over here. Rashi says we're talking about that she actually owns the goat or the sheep or whatever, and the husband is entitled to the milk or the wool or whatever in the payers. Most other Rishonim learn that it means that, the Rif, for example, learns this way. It means she b'chlal doesn't own the goat in the first place. She herself only owns the milk from the goat. She made a deal with somebody else. I'm buying from you You're continuing to own this goat. I'm buying from you the right to collect all the milk from it. Or you own this sheep. I'm buying the right to all the wool that's going to produce in the future. We're saying then that the husband is entitled to those payers. He's entitled to that very milk or wool or what have you. Yeah. Even though when the animal buys, she doesn't have a keren left because she never owned the animal in the first place. Nevertheless, that's how it works. And Amar Rav Nachman, Ayla like glima peir.
There's no keren.
There's no keren. There's no keren because Shema Chatzila, she didn't have a keren.
She took
my keren until the keren is gone. Yeah.
You can have peres and someone else's keren.
Karen means until the Karen is used up and her deal is over. Now she's not getting anything more out of this animal. Okay, but up until that point,
she doesn't have to own the Karen for the Paris to go to the
husband. Amar Rav Nachman, a similar din. Ayla le glima. What if she brought into the marriage a cloak? Peirahavi. Then also the ability to wear it is considered Paris. Therefore, machasi beva ozel ad dekalia. Again, the husband now is entitled to wear this cloak until it wears out. And what happens when it wears out? She can keep the shmata, yeah. Like you might ask, Kaman Tihai Tana, who is that like? That's like the following Tana of this Braisa, the Tanya. Hamelach v'achol, if she inherits a place of salt or sand. So Rashi says salt is that she inherits a place near the beach where we dig holes in the ground and then get seawater into them, where the water evaporates and you have salt over there. Choil is she inherits a place where you can get good sand that's usable for building. Those are non-renewable resources. Hareza Paris, then it's considered Paris. We don't say, in other words, that it's considered Keren, which isn't producing Paris. Go make her sell it and buy some actual cultivable land, and he'll get the Paris from that. No, the salt or the sand itself is considered Paris. He's entitled to that until the salt or the sand gets used up. Pirsho Gofris, what if she inherits a sulfur mine? Machpordes Shotzrif, or she inherits an alum mine. Alum is a mineral. It contains aluminum. That's why it's called that. But they used to use it in those days for dyeing. It helps fix the dye to the material. Rameir Omer Keren, Machamim Omer Peres. Rameir says it's because there is Keren, because eventually the sulfur or the alum in the mine is going to get used up. Eventually the mine is going to get tapped out. In 1 minute. Therefore, it's considered keren. Therefore, you have to sell it and buy property with it, and then buy a cultivable field. But Chachamim Peres, Chachamim say that the keren is the land itself, the land on which the mine sits. The contents of the mine are considered peres. So he keeps on getting the sulfur or alum or whatever it is until it gets used up, and then she keeps the actual property itself. That's her keren. Yeah.